This is an independent radio documentary, Indian Residential Schools and Modern Child and Family Services, comparing concepts of cultural genocide. And I am your host, Dr. Robert Falcon Ouellette. This documentary is funded as a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, and that is made possible through the support of the Red Jam Slam Society, and is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development Canada. There is a national crisis line for listeners for emotions triggered by the contents of this documentary. The number is 1-866-925-4419. 1-866-925-4419. The documentary was produced by Tim Matten in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and UMFM. So here is the documentary, Indian Residential Schools and Modern Child and Family Services, comparing concepts of cultural genocide.
Mr. Speaker, I stand before you today to offer an apology to former students of Indian residential schools. The treatment of children in Indian residential schools is a sad chapter in our history. The 1870s, the federal government, partly in order to meet its obligations to educate Aboriginal children, began to play a role in the development and administration of these schools. Two primary objectives of the residential school system were to remove and isolate children from the influence of their home, families, traditions, and cultures, and to assimilate them into the dominant culture. These objectives were based on the assumption that Aboriginal cultures and spiritual beliefs were inferior and unequal. Indeed, some saw it, as was infamously said, to kill the Indian in the child. Today we recognize that this policy of assimilation was wrong, has caused great harm, and has no place in our country. To the approximately 80,000 living former students and all family members and communities, the Government of Canada now recognizes that it was wrong to forcibly remove children from their homes, and we apologize for having done this. We now recognize that it was wrong to separate children from rich and vibrant cultures and traditions, that it created a void in many lives and communities, and we apologize for having done this. We now recognize that in separating children from their families, we undermine the ability of many to adequately parent their own children, and sow the seeds for generations to follow. And we apologize for having done this. We now recognize that far too often, these institutions gave rise to abuse or neglect and were inadequately controlled. And we apologize for failing to protect you. Not only did you suffer these abuses as children, but as you became parents, you were powerless to protect your own children from suffering the same experience. For this, we are sorry. This commission represents a unique opportunity to educate all Canadians on the Indian residential schools system. It will be a positive step in forging a new relationship between Aboriginal peoples and other Canadians, a relationship based on the knowledge of our shared history, a respect for each other, and a desire to move forward with a renewed understanding that strong families, strong communities, and vibrant cultures and traditions will contribute to a stronger Canada for all of us. God bless all of you. God bless our land.
In 2008, the Canadian government officially and publicly apologized for its running of a system of Indian residential schools across Canada. It was abetted by religious organizations like the United Church, the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, Presbyterian Church, Baptist Church, Mennonite Church, and some non-denominational churches from the 1870s until 1996, when the last school was closed. It was a system that forcibly removed children from their homes and confined them to schools so they may receive an education that was to better prepare them for the end of the Indian way of life and their integration into Canadian society. Unfortunately, while the goals of education may have been laudable, it has produced some of the worst abuses in terms of human rights that Canada has ever seen in its entire history. In 2009, under court order, the federal government appointed Justice Mary Sinclair as Chief Commissioner for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, tasked with investigating this period of Canadian history. Justice Sinclair, while publicly speaking at Migiagimik or Aboriginal House at the University of Manitoba on February 16, 2012, and who after years of investigation into government and church archives, and after having heard thousands of hours of testimony, labeled this part of Canadian history a cultural genocide.
Well, if it can be safely concluded that the intent was to destroy the culture and thereby destroy the race of people known as Indigenous peoples in this country, one does not have to have the entire destruction occur. Not all people have to be killed. That's not the measure of the act of genocide. Measure of genocide is in the intent and in the actions that were performed in support of that intent. But as a commission, we began with the premise that the intention behind the government is exactly what the government said. And if you would like to see a list of all of the things that the government declared to be their intention, then just look at the parliamentary debates of the day. Look at the papers that will be circulated following this symposium, because there are several individuals who are quoted within that, all of which I think is best reflected in the quote that many people are aware of from Duncan Campbell Scott, who in the early part of the 20th century said that the intent of the policy of residential schools was to do away with Aboriginal people so that they no longer existed as a people. And that intent was in fact early on expressed by individuals such as Sir John A. Macdonald, Sir Hector Langevin, and senior bureaucrats within the Department of the Interior. And if the acts that were done in terms of creating residential schools, in passing laws to prevent parents from removing the children from the schools, in passing the laws that were put in place in order to require parents to send their children to the school, in prosecuting the parents for failing to send their children to the schools, in rounding up the children and forcibly taking them out of their communities in large numbers and transporting them to the schools, in returning them to the schools after they had run away against their wills, and in punishing them at the school for refusing to participate in the process of acculturation or indoctrination that the schools were all about, is in fact seen in the context of the attempt to wipe out Indigenous cultures in this country. And I cannot see any other conclusion but that genocide was at work here. And if that is the case, the real question is not whether or not it occurred in law. The real question is, what do we do about this?
For the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, cultural genocide is intimately connected to the act of removing children from their family. According to the United Nations, this definition of genocide is listed in Section C of the definition of the term itself. According to this interpretation, if the government was in fact removing children for the purpose of indoctrinating them with a new culture in order to destroy their own, then the residential school period was beyond any doubt engaged in the act of cultural genocide.
The analysis being that if you take children away and remove them from their culture and deny to them access to their culture and prevent them from ever finding out about their culture in the future, then that culture will die. And the intent of the genocidal provision, among others in that provision, was to protect culture from being eliminated or exterminated in that way.
In Canada, residential schools fit into then-political beliefs concerning social Darwinist ideology. Social Darwinism was inscribed into the political edifice of the state with policies that reflected the belief that Indigenous peoples were predestined to disappear from the earth. The government did not see itself as responsible for safeguarding the past traditional cultural practices of Indigenous peoples, but should intentionally contribute to the destruction of this backward way of life. The goal of the residential schools was so eloquently said by Stephen Harper, to kill the Indian in the child. While in the care of the state, at least a minimum of 3,000 cases have been confirmed of children dying. These deaths were often claimed to be the result of so-called natural processes. Indians, according to policy, were a weak race that could not survive in a westernized environment, and the strong and the most able to adapt would rise to the top. Some have termed the IRS a form of penitentiary, where children were alienated from their parents, forced to do hard physical labor, little access to reading and writing skills, and forced to endure various forms of psychological torture that could range from neglect to sexual or physical abuse. These church-run mission schools were contracted by the government to operate with participation from the RCMP, child welfare, and other government departments. The schools had the right to abduct and incarcerate Indigenous children without the consent of their families or their communities. It is estimated 50% of Indigenous children during this era suffered placement in these schools. The policy was founded by Sir John A. Macdonald and Duncan Campbell Scott, who coined the term to kill the Indian in the child, and explicitly depicted the intent of the schools to be a program of cultural genocide designed to erase Indigenous peoples from the face of the earth. In 1879, Duncan Campbell Scott joined the Federal Department of Indian Affairs. He became its deputy superintendent in 1913, a post he held until his retirement in 1932. He was also known as an early Confederation short story writer and a poet. His real ambition was to become a doctor, but his family's finances were precarious, and he was forced to become a federal civil servant. Duncan Campbell Scott, while giving evidence before a special committee of the House and Commons in 1920, said,
"I want to get rid of the Indian problem. I do not think, as a matter of fact, that the country ought to continuously protect a class of people who are able to stand alone. Our objective is to continue until there's not a single Indian in Canada that has not been absorbed into the body politic, and there's no Indian question and no Indian department. That is the whole object of this bill."
This program of cultural genocide was approbated by Canadian education greats like Egert Ryerson, who designed and implemented the public school policies adopted by Ontario, Manitoba, and other English-speaking provinces. The other 50% of Indigenous children who could not be found in residential schools were primarily found among other children in the public school system, where they had similar experiences compared to those in residential schools due to the racist curriculum designed to approbate derogatory, criminalizing, and abusive behaviors against their person and their culture. Dr. Andrew Wolford from the University of Manitoba, a specialist in residential schools and genocide, describes the Indian residential school experience.
Very terrible. Physical and sexual abuse is often what comes to mind, but and abuse is one of the most heart-wrenching aspects of the schools. But it's not even that that we require in order to think about it in terms of genocide. I mean, what we need to think about is the children, the ways in which the children were severed from their families, their family and community lives were degraded and diminished by the people at the schools. Even people who were being kind to the children, you know, you look at some of the archival records, the ways in which they were being kind was offering them a new family, offering them fatherly or motherly care, but that was in replacement of the fatherly and motherly care they would have received at home. So there, the children are being severed from the community, and the community is losing the next generation as they're being, you know, all sorts of different strategies are then, different techniques are being used to separate them from their cultures, from their daily education, from their work, from the ways in which they eat and the food they eat, to how they pray, how they march, how they, you know, their bodies, their minds are being trained in order to fit to another culture. It doesn't mean this necessarily all works. There's lots of resistance within the schools, but the schools are really set up as disciplinary institutions intended to reform, transform children so that they no longer fit into their original community, and so that therefore those communities will be transformed, changed forever, destroyed.
While the work of the TRC is occurring, there have been accusations that even though Canada is in the process of atoning for its sins of its forefathers, a continued cultural genocide is still taking place, with the forcible removal of Aboriginal children from their homes. It concerns the accusation that child welfare agencies run by provincial or Aboriginal organizations are perpetuating the same issues of the residential schools, but in a more diffused manner. We have set out to uncover if it is true that there is a continued cultural genocide. We have set out to answer this question by approaching professional social workers, academics, survivors, and community activists working in the field. Native Studies graduate student Tim Matten spent National Aboriginal Day in Winnipeg on June 21, 2013, where he met with local musician, community worker, and political advocate Leonard Sumner and asked, "Can we make the link between Indian residential schools and child and family services?"
Today we're asking people about child and family services, and we're asking people if they think that a comparison can happen between the child and family services and residential schools.
I think it is definitely a comparison can be made, and there are similarities with the way they're operated. I think a lot of it has to do with poverty line. A lot of that's one of the main factors of taking children from their home is if they feel they're living in poverty, right? I guess the reasoning for residential schools was to kill the Indian in the child. So it's can't compare them directly, but they're very similar as young people are being taken from their homes and being raised in families there that may not be of their relations. So.
Do you see funding gaps as contributing to assimilation?
I don't think it really depends on funding, right? Like, I think growing up in poverty is one thing, but growing up without love is completely different, right? You can grow up in poverty and come from a loving household and learn a lot of things and be a good person from there. There are, if child is in danger, if the child is malnourished, then definitely they should be put in hands of people that can take care of them. But if they're below the poverty line and they're healthy, I think they should remain with their families.
In Canada, many Aboriginal children are still being forcibly removed from their homes. But does it amount to cultural genocide? According to Statistics Canada, 48% of the 30,000 children in foster care today are Aboriginal, yet Aboriginal peoples only account for 4.3% of the Canadian population. Why are the children being taken in such large numbers? We talked with a frontline worker of the Child and Family Services system who asked not to be identified. She talked about a system which is under tremendous stress. Children who are left in unsafe conditions, children who were removed from stable foster families because decision makers wish to demonstrate their legal power, underpaid workers, workers who lack the necessary skills and education to complete their jobs properly, the stealing of agency resources meant for children's services, foster families fighting over children because of the amount of money the child can bring to the family, are just some of the issues she raised. Here she discusses a case of a child who was 13 taken from a foster family where he had lived since he was a child. He was taken for simply administrative reasons and the demonstration of power.
To speak for himself, like, he knows me, he has my phone number, he knows the agency, he knows even his last worker that he has for many years. So he had this opportunity to phone, pick up the phone anytime he's out in and he could have called us at any point in time. We would have gone out there right away and picked him up at any point in time. But I knew that was not the case. He was happy there. I asked him how he was and blah, blah, blah. And he was good. And then this incident happened. The other worker, she went out there, and she's a seasoned one. She's been there doing this work longer than I had, and she's also been a counselor beforehand. So why would I not trust her judgment? So she went out there. She did a look. She asked him how he was. He said he was fine. That was done. Came back, and then all of a sudden they're trying to throw me under the bus, and I'm like, nope, that's not the way it is. It would be detrimental to take this child out. He's safe. He's fine. So ended up having a conversation with my supervisor because I came back and she calls me up at 6:30. I got in at like 3:30, talking with my daughter for a little while and then going to start something to eat. Nope. I was called up, told that I had to go pick him up. And I was like, what? I said, this is not going to be good for him. This is the only place that he's known of since he was a baby and he's 13 years old. I said, this would be detrimental. We cannot do this. This is a foster family, but they've also been trying to adopt him. But he's also from Saskatchewan, and they do not allow that.
I asked the worker if she was really obliged to remove the child from a family in which he was stable.
Oh, I had to do it anyway. I had to do it. If I didn't, I would have lost my job. So I had to find somebody to go with me, because it was already after work. And so that took a little while doing, because they live out of... So it's finding the place at night... We end up going down there, plus the foster parents very upset. His wife is not there. She's off on a little weekend outing. So it's himself and the kids, you know, and then he's upset. I'm trying to calm him down because so he does not get the child all upset neither, right? But, I mean, This man's having this child taken out of his life because of an incident that had happened that they had no control of. You know, they don't know what happened. Nobody really knows what happened. I end up going down there with my coworker, and we take him. And this poor child, he's just really upset, right? And I'm like, oh my God. So we take him back to the city, and where do we put him? In a shelter. We didn't even have the correct letter, because we're supposed to have a letter from the foster department and take it down to the foster parent themselves and let them read it and the reasons why. That was not followed. That was not done. So then after all this, comes into the city, and then he takes me into the office. Thank God was there. And so he called me into the office. I went in there, and he's tried to, because it was his doing, so he was going to get canned. He was going to get in trouble for this, right? And he's trying to blame me. He's trying to put me under the bus. It's like, oh, no, no, no. I said, in my understanding of the welfare, the child welfare system here, I said, we're here for the well-being of these children. I said, and that's what I was doing, is making sure that this child was safe. And this child was safe where he was at. I said, it was detrimental that we took him out, because it mentally, it really did a number. So I'm hoping that the next worker has gotten some therapy for this child, because he's going to need that now. Get this, right after that, he said, okay, we'll take him back to the family. Well, we can't do that now. We can't do that now. We have to follow the procedures now of everything. You know, it's terrible. It's just crazy. But that's what I'm saying. Like, when somebody gets this egotistical, you know, oh, I'm almighty and all this, and everybody has to jump and listen to what I say, it really gets out of hand. And there's a lot of that in the CFS.
Many of these issues in CFS stem from the lack of funding that many of the Aboriginal agencies receive from the federal and provincial governments. The question is, are these agencies really set up to succeed, or have they been set up to fail the children?
They never wanted them to work. They were only supposed to work for 6 months they gave them, and that was it. They were never included into the books in Parliament, because they thought that we'd be closed by 6 months' time.
How do you people view the Child and the Family Services here in Manitoba?
Child and Family Services. Well, I was a permanent ward of Child and Family Services, raped for 4 years by my foster parent, which I'm not allowed to publicize. He was given 2 years house arrest and 2 years probation in the community with no...
The person's voice you've been hearing is Judy Monaco. She was awarded the state at one point, but due to the graphic nature of some of the material, I have decided not to play her entire interview. She felt, though, that while her experiences were in the extreme, they still had an adequate representation of many of the experiences of children in Child and Family Services. We can only hope that it is better today. If these are the abuses that are occurring, why are we not changing the system? Why is the legislation not changed? The website of the Child and Family Services in Manitoba says,
"The Child and Family Services CFS system helps to ensure that families and communities provide for the safety and well-being of their children. There are a number of provincial laws that are in place to accomplish this goal. The most important ones are the Child and Family Services Act, the Adoption Act, and the Child and Family Services Authorities Act."
Even though the description here does not inspire much confidence, it refers to other documents that should be consulted. The Child and Family Services Act, in the Declaration of Principles, says,
"The Legislative Assembly of Manitoba hereby declares that the fundamental principles guiding the provision of services to children and families are 1. The safety, security, and well-being of children and their best interests are fundamental responsibilities of society. 2. The family is the basic unit of society, and its well-being should be supported and preserved. 3. The family is the basic source of care, nurture, and acculturation of children, and parents have the primary responsibility to ensure the well-being of their children. 4. Families and children have the right to the least interference with their affairs to the extent compatible with the best interests of children and the responsibilities of society. 5. Children have a right to a continuous family environment in which they can flourish. 6. Families and children are entitled to be informed of their rights and to participate in the decisions affecting those rights. 7. Families are entitled to receive preventative and supportive services directed to preserving the family unit. 8. Families are entitled to services which respect their cultural and linguistic heritage. 9. Decisions to place children should be based on the best interest of the child and not on the basis of the family's financial status. 10. Communities have a responsibility to promote the best interest of their children and families and have the right to participate in services to their families and children. 11. Indian bands are entitled to the provision of child and family services in a manner which respect their unique status as Aboriginal peoples.
Taz Boucher is an elder, pipe carrier, social worker, and political advocate from Edmonton, presently running for political office. Here she describes the CFS experience and its relationship to culture and the ideas of cultural genocide.
Child systems, our child welfare systems and child services systems are contributing to the demise of the people. I suggest that it is, again, another form of legal abduction because their assessments are not even accurate. I haven't studied psychology myself. I definitely haven't got my degree in psychology, but I did study psychology and in university. And so at that time, I was telling people, this is culturally biased teaching. And the professors at that time said, yes, it is. Then I said, why do you continue to teach it to Aboriginal people? Then psychologists should not be working with my people anywhere, even doing the assessments with the children for child services. They should not be doing it unless they are trained to be culturally competent. And that means spending an awful lot of time with elders, spending an awful lot of time developing understanding of historical trauma, how it took place, because those are not things that they teach in mainstream education. It's just recently that those things are brought to light with the apology by Canada, by the Prime Minister. People are understanding, wait a minute, we're missing the boat. And that's why the increase in numbers are happening everywhere, whether it be child services, justice departments, correctional facilities, wherever. The result is astronomical. And part of it is still culturally biased interventions.
I later spoke with Professor Yvonne Papano from the University of Manitoba about her thoughts about child and family services. As I was explaining, we're doing a documentary on residential schools, but I was interested in the question of child and family services and criticisms that people have made that it's in fact a new form of residential school. And I was wondering if I could have your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I gave that a little bit of thought, and I think sort of my conclusion on that was it might not necessarily be a fair accusation to say that the CFS system is an extension of the residential school. I think, however, the outcome of the CFS system has certainly very similar to the residential school system, just in terms of the numbers of children who have been taken out of their home and the negative impact of that in terms of the culture would certainly be a similarity. But the intention behind the residential school, was purposeful in terms of its attempt to assimilate children into the mainstream culture. I think that the child and family service system itself might not necessarily have been as intentional, but the outcome has certainly been the same.
What can we be doing to ensure that this system will not be producing the same results as the residential school era? Is it a question of funding? Is it a question of more money, of the government providing more resources to ensure that children have what they need? Do you think it's a question of funding, or do you think it's a question of structure?
I would say it's probably a combination of several factors, and certainly, the numbers of dollars that one puts into a system does not necessarily guarantee a positive outcome. I think that we have, a child welfare system, at least currently in the province of Manitoba, that could have been set up differently than it had been. I think it was difficult in terms of the capacity wasn't there for them to take such a huge undertaking in terms of having cases transferred to them. There are still policies and standards that are being established within, the urban center that are then supposed to be applied equally across all child and family service agencies, and that just sort of seems a bit impossible, given the socioeconomic circumstances in First Nation communities.
On June 21st, Tim Matten spoke to Lee Gott, a social worker in Manitoba, about his experience dealing with parents and if the blame should only be shared by the state.
Lee Gott, I work for Awassa's Child and Family Services, and there's not enough of Lee Gotts, you know, to help the children to provide. But still, you know, there's the problem. I go all over to remote communities up north. They fly me around.
Yeah.
What I see is when they take the children away from the parent, they, you know what I mean? They stop getting hugs and everything else and babied and pampered and this. And we never learned that. I mean, we never had that because of residential school.
Tim Matten also interviewed Val Williams, who is a diversity consultant at the University of Manitoba, during the Truth and Reconciliation event held there on June 21st.
Better screening for the foster parents, for sure,
yeah, yeah.
But a priority needs to be on the parenting skills,
yeah, yeah,
and helping these children stay in their community with their parents. That's where they need to be.
Can you talk about whether this is well connected to the Truth and Reconciliation environment that we're in right now?
Oh yeah, it is. It
yeah,
is.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Do you see the link there? Have we really progressed? We keep taking children away from their parents. We keep removing them from their homes. Would you agree?
Yes.
Yeah.
Put it that way.
Yeah.
Currently, there is a court case concerning child and family services offered to Aboriginal children and the funding or lack of funding offered by the federal government, who has responsibility for First Nations people on reserve. In February of 2007, the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada and the Assembly of First Nations filed a human rights complaint alleging that the Government of Canada's provision of child and family services on reserve is discriminatory. The Canadian government has spent over 6 years and $3 million in its unsuccessful attempts to derail a full and proper hearing based on the merits of the case. In the fall of 2012, the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal amended the Child and Family Services complaint to include allegations that the Government of Canada retaliated against the Caring Society and Dr. Cindy Blackstock, the Executive Director, and this contrary to Sections 14-1 of the Canadian Human Rights Act. The retaliation allegations are largely based on government documents showing that officials from the Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development Canada blocked the Caring Society from carrying out its mandate of providing expert advice to First Nations on child and family services. Further, it is alleged that Canada retaliated against Dr. Cindy Blackstock personally when officials from ANSI and the Department of Justice collected personal information about her via accessing her personal Facebook page, Indian registry files, and conducting systematic monitoring of her activities.
It's time to fight for human rights, a whole red revolution. It's time to unite. It's time to fight for indigenous rights.
Mary Lynn Bennett, a social worker, while very adamant about the importance of the human rights case and the need for more funding, brought us back to the fundamentals. She felt the needs of the children must always be paramount.
What they're arguing for is they're arguing that they want more money to be able to provide the same kind of services that the non-Aboriginal child welfare system provides. But the problem I have a bit with that is when you use the rights of children to get rights for another system.
Not my color, the color of my skin, for I am a sister, a brother, a kin. Let's all come together to create a better world, marching together, all our flags unfurled. Oh, revolution, it's time to unite, it's time to fight for human rights. Drum is beating across the land. Your ancestors are calling to take a stand. Oh, revolution, it's time to unite. It's time to fight for human rights.
Once again, we return to the words of Justice Murray Sinclair, Commissioner of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada.
The intergenerational population also talk about the fact, when pushed, that the impact upon the school of the schools upon their daily lives was often reflected in the behavior and the treatment that they received at the hands of their parents and their grandparents. We have heard many times from survivors, those who have actually been in the schools, that the impact of the schools upon their lives resulted in their mistreating their spouses, their children, other members of their community. And many of the survivors who are now in their elder years talk about the fact that if there is one act of reconciliation that they would like to achieve in the course of their lifetime, it would be to be able to resolve their relationship with their children in a peaceful way and in a good and healthy manner. Many survivors talk about apologizing to their children for the way that they raised them, and looking, in fact, for forgiveness from their children as the ultimate act of reconciliation. But reconciliation for survivors often does not include reconciliation with the government or reconciliation with the churches. We are now aware, not only as a commission, but as a public, of the racism which sat behind the actions of the government of this country in developing and maintaining the schools and the policies behind them, for no reason relating to neglect or abuse, and institutionalizing them for years for the sole purpose of indoctrinating them into the beliefs of another culture. Black hair.
Before I leave you, I would like to leave these words. Will we soon have another apology, like the one for residential schools, but this time concerning child and family services? Have the unintended outcomes of this system, a form of structural violence that plagues too many children and families, be something that the government will have to atone for in the future? Is it too difficult for this system to change and to bring about outcomes which are positive for the families, cultures, and the children? You have been listening to a radio documentary, Indian Residential Schools and Modern Child and Family Services, Comparing Concepts of Cultural Genocide. And I'm your host, Robert Falcon Ouellette. This documentary is funded as a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Station, and it is also made possible through the support of the Red Jam Slam Society and is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada and Aboriginal Affairs Northern Development Canada. There is a national crisis line for listeners for emotions triggered by the documentary. The number is 1-866-925-4419. 1-866-925-4419. The documentary was produced by Tim Matten in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and UM-FM, with coordination from Michael Elves and Jared McKediak. We also use speaker Theo Jeffrey. For further information, you may go to our website at attheedgeofcanada.com, where you will find podcasts and textual information on Aboriginal issues. Thank you very much, and until next time, or in the Mi'kmaq language, the language of the Métis, merci à quoi qu'il toi.